Hello and welcome to A Bookish Home. I'm Laura Zara-Papinski. I'm so thrilled to share that my guest this week is Anne Braden, author of The Benefits of Being an Octopus, which I think is one of the best middle grade novels of the year. Hand this book immediately to fans of books like Wonder, Absolutely Almost, Out of My Mind. And then I highly recommend if you are a parent, educator, or librarian that you then get a second copy for yourself. The Benefits of Being an Octopus is Anne's middle grade debut, and it has received a starred review from School Library Journal and was described by Newbery Award winner Karen Hess as a compassionate look at poverty, hard choices, and defending one's right to be treated humanely. A very fine first novel written with a deft hand. Anne is the founder of Gun Sense Vermont. She's also started the Local Love Brigade and is a former middle school teacher. She is the co-host of the podcast Lifelines, Books That Bridge the Divide, and of course, a best-selling author. Anne Braden, welcome to A Bookish Home. I'm so happy I get to chat with you today.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. I'm so glad to be here.
Yes, well, I absolutely loved the book, The Benefits of Being an Octopus, and I know it's getting rave reviews. It's just such a wonderful kid-lit book, and I, you know, would like to just start for people who haven't gotten to read the book yet. Would you be able to describe it for listeners?
Sure. It's about a 12-year-old girl named Zoe, and she is dealing with all sorts of the realities of rural poverty, and, you know, she's got to take care of her little siblings while her mom works at the pizza restaurant, and she's in a good place right now because they finally have a stable home to live in. Her mom's new boyfriend, Lenny, has a nice trailer. And so she's excited about that. And she's just like, okay, we can't screw this up. So she's, she's dealing with a lot. And sort of to help her deal with that, she really loves octopuses. And she channels the octopus. It's got all the arms for juggling all the stuff she's got to do, but it's also really good at camouflaging itself. And at school, she wants to be as invisible as possible. So that's sort of her animal. But there's a teacher at school who sees through Zoe trying to be invisible and really sees her. And kind of steps in and is determined to make sure that Zoe starts taking herself seriously and starts to realize that she has a voice and can use it. And so the story is about Zoe finding the courage to actually use her voice.
Well, I love that you bring up the teacher. I think the teacher-student dynamic in here is so interesting, and you just paint such a realistic view of school life, I think. And I was curious, and I guess even to just like back up a little bit before we dive more into the book, you're a former middle school teacher. And so I was curious as I was reading, you know, where the inspiration came from, if there were middle grade books that you had really fallen in love with when you were teaching that your students were reading, or if you were noticing, I don't know what your population was like at your school, but that maybe there weren't books sort of reflecting your students' experiences. I'd love to just sort of hear how the book sort of started off in terms of your inspiration.
Yeah, well, I kind of want to go way back.
Because, as far back as you want.
So I grew up in a suburb in Connecticut, sort of near New York City, where money was very much a big thing. And I had a single mom, and we lived I just looked at people around me and thought, they have two parents. They live in nicer places than I do. They are better than me. And it was just that was a logical conclusion for me to draw. And when I was 12, I read Homecoming by Cynthia Voigt. Mm-hmm. And that book, it just blew my mind open. I don't know if your readers are familiar with it, but it's about this family, and Dicey's the oldest sibling, and they've been abandoned by their dad, and they're waiting for their mom to come back. They're in a shopping mall parking lot, and they're waiting for their mom to come back from the mall. And Dicey realizes that their mom just abandoned them too. And so the story is about these kids trying to get from one side of Connecticut to the other where their aunt lives in Bridgeport, and all on their own. And I just thought, oh my gosh, like if Dicey can deal with that, like I can deal with my stuff. And it just sort of gave me an entirely new perspective that I had not had before. And so that, I did not realize it at the time when I was writing this, but looking back, it's pretty obvious that I wanted this book to be for kids what that book was for me.
Oh, I think that's so powerful. And I'm sure it will be. And I think the way you were saying that, giving you a perspective you hadn't had before, I feel like those are the books I love the most because, you know, I've worked as a school librarian for a while. I'm taking the year off, but I always picture like, oh, like what if this gets into someone's hands who's like never seen their situation in a book, or, you know, they're struggling in a different way and the character inspires them. Like I get so excited thinking about like who this might really resonate with. And in your case, like, you know, we talk a lot about windows and mirrors in books. And I feel like in the case of The Benefits of Being an Octopus, I feel like it's going to be such a powerful mirror for some kids seeing themselves, and also like such a powerful window for other kids and for adults and teachers too, to sort of walk in Zoe's shoes. I think it's so powerful.
Yeah. And actually the most direct, the reason I wrote this book was because I was sitting next to a friend of mine. So the town where I live now, I'm in Vermont, and we have about, I think the schools are about 80% free and reduced lunch, the elementary school where my kids go to. So, and I taught at the middle school here before my kids are born. And so it's a very, and I also taught in a number of other schools, like in Connecticut, Massachusetts, that were very different in terms of socioeconomic, you know, makeup. And I was sitting next to this woman who was a guidance counselor at one of the elementary schools in our town. We were actually, our kids were in like a toddler class together. So we were watching. and they, she's like, you know, these kids never see themselves in books. Like they never, you never see rural poverty. They don't. And she's like, you're a writer. You should write that book.
I was like, that's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was funny because at first, I mean, I actually was in between manuscripts. And so I never know what I'm writing next when I finish one. So I was like, an idea. Yes. I will take it.
I'll take that.
But then the more I thought about it, the more I realized how, I mean, Zoe, I did not have to craft her as a character. She just came from me. Like she was, that was, I don't know if it was from teaching or from living for those like first 30 years, feeling completely inferior to the people around me. But the combination made it so that she just flowed right out of me. And I think that, you know, as a teacher, you know, you see these, and just like Miss Rochambeau, the teacher in the book is, she's the teacher I wish I could have been for all my students. You know, mm-hmm. And I think I was that teacher for some of my students, but the ones I remember are the ones I failed. And I just remember there was a girl who, she just had such attitude, and she would like leave the class in the middle of class, slam the door. And I thought, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? And I was so focused on her just like staying in the classroom, doing her work. And, you know, a few months later, you know, I was talking to the guidance counselor and she's like, well, you know, she's been homeless for a lot of the fall. And I thought, oh my gosh, like I had no idea. And yep. I was only thinking of her as a student, you know, and so I feel like I wrote this book in part because I'm still trying to process how I failed her.
Because I think that's so, you know, yeah. I just was going to say, you know, as someone who's been in education as well, like I kept thinking that as I was reading, because it's true. There's so many times where we do just see kids as the student in front of us. And there were so many instances where you're thinking, and I don't know how much the kids will see this, but as an adult reading, I'm like, oh, I wish her teacher knew that this just happened. And this is why she doesn't have her debate packet. And this is why she's giving attitude right now, because that just happened last night. And, you know, it's such a good reminder. And of course, we try to do this to think about, you know, what kids have going on at home. But, you know, in her case, it's like, oh, if you only knew. I mean, there's this scene toward the beginning where Zoe is picking up her her baby brother at the pizza place where her mom works. And then she's getting the other two little kids off the Head Start bus and they're like rushing across the highway and the kids are crying. And I'm just like, oh my gosh, you're 12 and you are wrangling these kids like, you know, an adult mom would have a hard time in this situation. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, oh, I wish the, you know, and her teacher does, you know, reach out. And I feel like she starts to see what's going on, but it's like, oh, it's such a good reminder that you don't know someone's story.
Right. Right. And I, you know, I think in some ways it's like kids, you know, they are doing their best to cover it up too. Right. Mm-hmm. So like the kids that need the most love are putting up the biggest walls. Mm-hmm. And so it's like you've got to look through all those walls and you've got to keep trying regardless of how many times that kid is like, I don't need you. I'm not listening. Go away. You're bothering yep. me, you know.
And she doesn't go easier on her either, which I really liked. I mean, she gives some tough love and keeps pushing. It's not like she says, oh, she's got these challenging circumstances. I'm not going to, you know, expect right. much of her.
It's, right. Because that's the balance that, you know, it's like, okay, you understand that these kids are dealing with all this stuff, but you also need to continue to have high expectations. It just looks different. You know, right. doing homework for Zoe is not a priority. As much as, you know, learning to take herself seriously and speak up. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, it's that different, it's differentiated instruction at its finest.
It is at its best. Well, you, I know I had read somewhere, maybe in your acknowledgments about how, I don't know if it was this manuscript or an earlier manuscript, but I thought it was so inspiring that you were writing, you know, your newborn was sleeping in one arm.
That was an earlier one. That was a very bad manuscript.
Yeah. To hear about that though, and were you writing before that or
no.
did motherhood sort of spur that on?
Yeah, motherhood was, I mean, God, I just feel like I've discovered who I am as a person when I became a mother. Yeah, I never thought of myself as a writer ever. Like I thought, and actually, I was reading. So I was, my son would only sleep if I was holding him and like he'd falling asleep. And then I'd be stuck on the couch for like 3 hours because he took long naps when I was holding him. So it was worth the, yep. He was a happy child as long as I stayed put. And so I was reading a lot, which I had not had time to do as a teacher, I must say. And I was reading Louise Erdős's Blue Jay Dance, which is, it's sort of a memoir at a time when she had a newborn. And she talks about, you know, bringing her newborn to the writing studio in the woods. And I was like, oh, that sounds so lovely. Like, wouldn't it be nice to be a writer? Which is, I think, hilarious that that's my, you know, that was my idea of what it would be like. But
I think that's a lot of people's ideas. Yeah. It's mine. I just like write in the woods and yeah. like a cabin.
Do it with the baby, yeah. You know, just sleeping. but then the next sentence that I remember it so vividly, I was like, well, but creative writing is one of the things I know I can't do. Like that was something I had thought it before. You know, I'd had gotten confirmation of it in the past. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I can't do that. And so, but I was still on the couch for another 3 hours. And so somewhere along there, I was like, well, but if I was going to write something, what would I write? And then I was still on the couch. And I was like, you know, maybe it would be this kind of setting, or maybe it would be this kind of character. And it was just sort of, I just sort of circled around. And I mean, partly it was because I had, my brain was starved for mm-hmm. any kind of stimulus. During, you know, my son was 6 months old, so it had been a while. And he had been a preemie, so he was kind of like a newborn for a very long time. And yeah, I just kind of started circling around this actual story, and it was kind of just fun. And then I got a little netbook and I typed this manuscript one-handed while holding my son with the other. And it was so short. Each sentence was a triumph in and of itself. It was just like, oh my goodness. The sentence had 7 words. but it showed me that I could write a story. Like I just wasn't someone who had stories coming out of them. But that I could create it from the ground up, and that it could, I could go one step at a time, and that I loved doing it. And I loved how my mind was engaged with the people. And just, you know, I think as a teacher, you are always, you know, thinking about other people's perspectives and thinking about how other people feel and how to get them involved. And you're just in other people's heads all the time. And so this was a way to use that skill from my couch. And so,
so interesting.
Yeah.
Did you start off right away with kids as the main characters? Since
yeah,
that was sort of the
I've always, I think every manuscript I've written has had, has been about 12-year-olds. Maybe 13.
Well, then say, write what you know.
Yeah. I think I started at 13 and then I realized you don't actually get any 13-year-old characters published. So then I went to 12. I was like, I can do that. I also taught seventh grade.
Yeah. There you go. And were there, I'm just always so interested in like the writing process and sort of your creative journey. So there, were there a lot of different manuscripts before this
yes.
one?
Yes. Yes. This was the sixth one. So I basically wow. wrote one every year that my son was alive. I mean, he's still alive, but, every year of his life, I think is the way to say it. But the, so the first one was really bad, but it showed me I like this. This, the, for the second one, I actually had researched what it takes to get published. And, it said on average 7 years. And I was like, okay, I've got 7 years before my kids are in kindergarten. I didn't even have a second kid yet, but she existed on my family spreadsheet of like, these are my plans. and so the second one, I was able to get lots of requests from agents, but they all said no. And I was like, okay, well, it was a good concept. Bad writing. The third one, I got an agent, and she was really excited about it. And then, but it didn't get an editor. Like you need, the next step is to find the editor who's going to publish it. And then right. the fourth and fifth one, oh, I love those. I really was convinced that at least one of those was going to sell. Like they were so, I love the stories and they were really sort of kind of catchy concepts. And when I started this one, I was convinced one of those would have sold and that I wouldn't need to actually attract an editor. I would already have an editor. And this, I was like, well, I'm just going to be honest and I'm not going to make it a flashy story. I'm just going to start with this girl and be real. And so it's beautiful irony wow. that, you know, that this is that that's what actually sold. And now that I've written this one, I told my agent to take those other ones off submission because I was like, oh, it's like I hit a different level of writing with this mm-hmm. one.
How did you manage to, you know, keep your spirits up and keep going and feel like, you know, it's gonna happen eventually and it's worth it to keep going.
You always have to believe that the one you're writing is the one that's gonna make it. Like I was completely convinced that number two was gonna do it. And then number three, you know, like I had complete faith in every single one of them. And I think that, and you always also have to be writing a new thing when you're on submission with the previous one. Because then when you're getting no's, you're like, that's okay, because this next one is the one that's really gonna, hit. So those were two
things. What a great story to share with kids. I don't know if you're sharing that at author visits or anything, but I mean, I think the perception even for adults is that, you know, poof, you wrote this book.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
In a few months and now it's a huge success. And to know the backstory, I think is just so, just makes it that much sweeter that it's, you know, getting all the praise and success it has now.
Yeah. I mean, I really feel like I am living proof that anyone can write a good book because I was not a writer. Was not at all. It's just a matter of sort of listening deeply to what other people feel and are thinking. I should say that another part of it is having the courage to say what is really true. Mm-hmm. And not worrying what, if other people are going to hate it. Because if you're sort of sugarcoating things or, you know, sort of not going deep into those yucky issues, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't ring as true. And but to go deep, you're gonna upset people. There's gonna be people that disagree. And I had, because of like other things that I was doing in my life, I had sort of found my own courage to speak up, and be bullied and continue to speak regardless of the bullies, and find out that the bullies really stopped bullying me after a while when I kept going. And so that was another really important piece in all of this. It wasn't just the writing, it was also the living, and finding that bravery in myself.
Well, you mention, I think it's in the acknowledgments, maybe kind of along these lines, that you were sort of seeing this as, I think you said sort of, it was like writing a better world, maybe. Did you have that in your mind as you were writing? And I know, you know, you tackle, you know, we've mentioned rural poverty. You go into like gun ownership and gun violence and domestic violence. And, you know, there's tough stuff in here. And I know you're saying you sort of have to be like brave and put the truth out there. And I guess, how did you go about that? And sort of, what were you hoping the story would do?
My ultimate goal for this book is to start conversations. Because I think that these are issues that are really important and not discussed as much as they need to be, because they are difficult and they are hot button issues. But only when we discuss things, especially when there's like books make things safer to discuss. I Skyped last night with a book club in Massachusetts, actually, a parent kid book club in Belmont. Who read this book. And it was actually, the kids were on the younger side. They were 8. And, you know, one of the moms said, you know, this, I wasn't, you know, going into it, I wasn't sure if this was going to be appropriate for 8. And I cannot tell you how valuable the conversations we've had have been, and how, like, it was the perfect way to approach these issues and help us come out of our bubble, but in a safe way and in a productive way. And, you know, I am such a advocate for sort of just civil discourse and just this idea that our world will be better when we stop yelling at each other.
This is such a good jumping off point for that. I mean, I love the idea of using it in a parent-child book club, or I think it would be such a wonderful classroom read aloud, and I'm sure lots of teachers are sharing it with their students. I mean, I can only imagine the different conversations happening in schools around the country, really, about this, and people may be seeing things in a slightly different way for the first time. And
what I'm so excited about. I think both people, you know, I think off, like, so I was very involved in advocating for Common Ground in the issue of guns in Vermont. And that experience, you know, it really taught me how much the emotional baggage around a lot of these hot button issues are connected to everyone feeling like they're being judged or not listened to by the other side. And so, like, that judging piece is something that we have control over. You know, we can't necessarily make everything better, but we have our own, in our own world, in our own circle, we can sort of cross some of those divides and help, you know, help everyone understand the other person better and make sure that we are listening fully and not judging ourselves. And so I think that, you know, I have a long game.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. You know, I'm sure, like everyone, you know, I'm clamoring for more of your books, and I'm curious if, you know, what's in the works next, and if you're going to kind of continue to work on, you know, different issues to have people be having conversations around, or shining a light on different populations? Is there anything in the works yet?
Yeah, I'm working on something. It's not, I'm looking for a new publisher because of some complications with my publisher. Had to fire their entire children's division in April. So
oh gosh. They're
no longer, it does not work. So it's not, I don't have a contract for it yet, but I'm working on, a new book that, you know, it's from four different perspectives, from four kids living in very different parts of the country. And it gets at that same, you know, some of those political divides and how one tiny action from a stranger can have entire, like, huge ripple effects, and how
that
connection that we can make across those divides. So I'm really
great. That sounds great. I always felt like too, when I would be like book talking books in the library and things, if I said, and it's got, you know, different points of view, so you're able to see the story from different perspectives, from different kids, or be like, ooh, like, we want that one. That's, I just feel like they love that. And adults too. It's just like nice. It sort of forces you to be looking at things in different ways and the same events and everything. So yeah, I love that.
I do too. And it's ironic because my very first manuscript, the very bad one, was like in five or six different points of view.
So
I'm coming full circle. Because I was like, I love books like that. I'll write one.
Well, I'm sure your writing routine has changed a lot through the years, but I'm curious, I always love to hear, like, are you someone who like has to get up every morning at a certain time and get in a certain number of pages, or is it sporadic? What's your sort of routine like?
Well, it's funny because I do not write every day unless I'm drafting or I'm like really intensely revising. So I'm not someone who's like, I have to write every day, but I do have to get up at 5 a.m. every day. Because it helps my brain just process. And so usually if I'm like in a big writing spurt, I write from 5 to 7. And I, like this past, so I was really struggling to write, but, you know, basically after the last presidential election, I had not written much. And I, this book sold and I was like, wow, that's great. I mean, more than that, but I was like, but I have, you know, I'm not mentally, like, I just don't have a new thing. I just couldn't quite. It's for me, starting a new project, it's like, I'm looking at a face, like a blank, rock face, and I have to figure out where the foothold is to start climbing. And it takes me a while to figure out where that foothold is. And last April, I basically passed out because Karen Hess blurbed my book, which when I talked to her a few days later, to thank her again, and she's like, so you have to be writing the next thing. And I was like, aw. She's like, when are you going to write? And I said, early morning. And she said, and if someone asks you to breakfast, what are you going to say? And I said, I cannot go because Karen Hess told me I can't.
I love that.
And my book was coming out in early September. So I made myself a goal of getting 45,000 words done by September 1st. And I use this program Scrivener, which counts your words, and it's like gives a little ding when you hit your word count for the day, which makes me very happy. and so that meant 400 words a day from April through, August, you know, the end of August. And I hit it. I did not actually finish the manuscript because turns out it's longer than that, but, 45,000 words. And so I had a draft to work through, you know, because revising is, I love revising. It's so much easier than drafting for me. So
when you're not starting from scratch.
Right.
Did I read something too? I feel like this was you, that you used to write at like 2 a.m. or something when your kids were really little.
Oh yeah. I don't know where I've written that, but yes, it's true. Like, I feel like I shouldn't admit that. But yeah, I remember, gosh, how was it? I guess I was going to sleep at like 8.
Mm-hmm.
And waking up at 2 and writing from 2 to 4 and then going back to sleep.
And, wow. That was commitment.
I wasn't setting an alarm. I just was waking up. I had my computer by my bed, so I wasn't getting out of bed. I was just like, you know, shifting the computer to on my belly and typing. And thankfully, my husband sleeps through everything. So.
Oh, that's funny. Well, as a mom to a toddler, I find that inspiring.
I don't know. Sleep is really important, though. You know, I think if you're going to be awake anyway, it makes sense. Don't wake up
during nap times. Yeah. That's funny. Well, I do want to say, too, I recently started listening to your podcast, and I want to give a shout out to that as well. And I will definitely link to it in the show notes. It's like a bridge between, is that what it's called?
Lifelines, books that bridge the divide.
Lifelines, books that bridge the divide. And I loved the description. And I feel like this sort of sums up like not only your book, but I feel like this segment of books like Wonder and Absolutely Almost and Out of My Mind, all those books that just touch our hearts so much. You write, and then the podcast, you share conversations with librarians, educators, and readers about the children's books that can be bridges across our cultural divides, the books that can open minds, and the books that can be the lifeline the child needs to remember they're not alone. I just think that's so powerful. I hope people check that out as well. And I like to end just asking, I always love to hear what authors and people in the book world have been reading lately. Is there a good book that you've been reading lately you'd want to recommend?
Yes. I am currently in the middle of Just Like Jackie by Lindsay Stoddard, which I'm loving. And
it sounds really familiar. Is that middle grade?
Yep. I only read middle grades. Occasionally YA. the main character is so angry. And she's a girl. And it's just a very real, it feels very real. And I for one thing, I think there needs to be more angry girls in books to give that space so that you can be that's also an option. But she's also that kid that's putting up all those barriers so that people can't help her. And so I'm so excited to keep reading and see how it develops, but I'm loving that one. And recently I also read Tight by Tori Maldonado, which was one of those books that I felt like my blood pressure is actually rising as, you know, as I was reading. It was like I was having a physical reaction to the book. Out of My Mind is similar, actually, where I just felt like I was in the book. I was living that life with the characters. And I love books like that. And Orbiting Jupiter is another favorite of mine. I mean, that book, I just sobbed and sobbed and sobbed. And I love books.
Well,
sob.
Well, your book is definitely one of those. I could not put it down, and the characters just felt so real to me. I still feel like I would just love to like meet Zoe in real life and see how she's doing. But I hope people will head over to their local bookstore or library to pick it up. And where can people find you if they want to follow you or learn more about you?
Well, my website is annbradenbooks.com. And so that's sort of the hub for everything. But then I'm also, I'm spending more time than I probably should be on Twitter recently. and that's also Ann Braden Books, and Instagram is Ann Braden Books. So basically, if you type Ann Braden Books into a social media platform, you'll find me.
I'm also good to go.
Yeah, you'll be good to go. I love the Kidlit community on Twitter. Like, I feel like it's such an incredible group of people. So if you're not on Twitter and you're an educator or a librarian, or like a parent of children. I don't know. Just feel like that corner of Twitter is an amazingly inspiring place.
I totally agree. And I meant to ask, actually, speaking of you and Twitter, you were, and I'm sure you still are, helping with the, helping start the Kids Need Mentors.
Yeah. Were is probably, I think were might be more accurate. I feel like I've done very little recently to help with that, but, But yeah, we had we paired, well, Jarrett Lerner and I, we had this sort of Twitter movement that started by mistake, but a very happy mistake, where I gave away a stack of books to an educator, you know, to educators who needed books for their kids last spring. And then Jarrett followed suit. And then all these other authors started giving away books from their bookshelf to, so they could get into the hands of actual kids. And so that was Kids Need Books. And then Jarrett and I were talking after that. And, you know, we really wanted to create something that was, you know, really combining, you know, getting creators like authors and illustrators to team up with classrooms. And so we teamed up with these two other awesome educators, Kristen Bacone and Kristen Crouch. And the four of us started Kids Need Mentors, which, you know, when we opened up signups for to like for both classroom teachers and librarians and also for authors, it was like, I think we had like 300 within a day. It was just kind of exploded.
I kept seeing it on Twitter. It's so exciting.
Yeah, we actually have a Twitter chat tonight, which is our first one. That should be fun.
So if people want to learn more about that, would they see that on your website as well?
Yeah, if you go to on my website, if you go to Connections and then Kids Need Mentors, you'll get to the sign up form. And if you're not doing it this year, sign up to be on the wait list right now so that you'll have a better chance in getting in next year. Because it's awesome. Cause I think we already have, I don't know, it's our demand is high.
I'm sure. Well, it seems like you're doing such great work, and I love the book, and I can't wait for her future titles from you. And I'm just so glad we were able to chat today. So thanks for coming on.
Thank you. This has been such a pleasure.
I hope you head over to your local library or bookstore to pick up your copy of The Benefits of Being an Octopus. To find out more about Anne, you can visit her website, annebradenbooks.com. And for the show notes and links to all of the books mentioned on this week's episode, you can head over to my blog, abookishhome.com. You can also follow me on social media at abookishhome. If you enjoyed this week's episode, share it with a friend or on social media, and it would also be so helpful if you could take a moment to rate and review in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening and happy reading!